This is the Senate State Affairs Committee, Tuesday, March 15th. Time is 3:40. Senator Davis is present, Senator Elton's present, and Senator Wagoner, who's filling in for Senator Terrio, who couldn't make it. First item before us today is Senate Bill 134, Police Investigation Standards and Arrests. Senator Bundy. Before you get started, well, go ahead and testify, then we'll talk about the CS.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Exalted Vice Chair.
Yes.
And committee members.
You're welcome.
Actually, I would like to adopt the CS.
You want the CS adopted first? Okay. Is there a motion?
Giving no indication of how I'm voting like that future. I'll move the CS. I assume it's CS for Senate Bill 134 / Y?
Yes. That's it.
Yeah.
Any objection?
Mr. Chairman, I also would like to preface my comments that at the request of the chair, we're introducing the bill, but we are also expecting other information from the Department of Public Safety.
The bill is not going to move today.
And we are simply introducing the bill, and would ask that there not be any further action until we receive the additional information.
Yeah, that's the whole reason. We're going to take testimony, but the bill is not going to move, and we'll hold it until scheduled next time.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I'll address the bill in general and the CS specifically. Mr. Chairman, as you're well aware and committee members are well aware, Alaska has an unfortunate and shameful legacy of leading the nation in sexual assaults. And Alaska is also a very diverse, small population, small communities. Communities that, if had more resources, would probably be more able to address our concerns about the level of sexual assault. And this bill is focused on trying to help rather than hinder or find fault, and it would require the Police Standards Council to set a level of standard for investigation in sexual assault and enforce these standards. Now, it's, as I said, a lot of small communities, and they may not have access to all the latest techniques, equipment, training, and may be unaware of the level of that the public would expect from them. And of course, as Alaskans travel from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, well, we would like to have some common standard, some expectation that we would be when we are in need of police enforcement, that we would be our expectations would be the same in Anchorage as they would be in a small community. And, we're looking at giving the council the power and the responsibility also to reprimand, discipline, or even revoke an officer's certification if they do indeed mishandle investigations. And while the vast majority, and I want to be very clear in my views here, that the vast majority of police officers are certainly doing the best that they can. They are held to an incredibly high standard, and I think they live up to that standard. But occasionally, there are people who are not knowledgeable enough, or for other reasons perhaps, do not maintain that standard. And I think much like the AMA or our medical association disciplines its own members, I think the Police Standards Council should would be the best people to decide on the professionalism of a police officer. The CS, we were discussing a requirement for arrest, and the CS changes that requirement to allow a little more flexibility for the police officers to when they should make an arrest and when they believe they have probable cause. While we, again, don't want to tie the hands of law enforcement, we are hopefully adding tools, and to quote a law enforcement official I spoke with recently, he doesn't know of any law enforcement officer who wouldn't appreciate having additional tools in dealing with people who are not capable of functioning in society and get involved in our unfortunate record on sexual assault. So why don't I leave it there, and with again the statement that this is a work in progress, and I expect to have additional information for you from the law enforcement community.
Are there any questions of Senator Bundy?
Must have done a good job. Thank you, Senator.
Yes, sir. You're welcome. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Excuse me just a minute. Let's just take a brief at ease here. We've got two people who'd like to testify on Senate Bill 134. Off net, Tamara DeLisa?
Yes.
Is that name right?
That is correct.
Well, I'm doing better.
I'm testifying in support from the Office of Victims' Rights.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. Specifically, we are supporting the measure that would standardize and require cases to be submitted to the district attorney for review. We would note that no statute on the books requires an officer to submit a case to the district attorney for review, and the opportunity to build standards and a standardized checklist that would be uniform for the whole state to follow in submitting cases to the DA and in pursuing those cases would be beneficial to the victims, especially in light of the high rates of sexual assault crimes in the state. The opportunity to build in standards to address the rural issues that are unique to Alaska should not be overlooked, and I consider this bill a good opportunity for the Police Standards Council to take advantage of this and allow some standardization that would kind of level the playing field and bring those rural communities kind of in line with a lot of what's going on in the bigger cities. You know, we don't have those investigatory problems in Anchorage and Fairbanks and Juneau, but there are small villages and rural communities that are at a great disadvantage because of the distance that they are from the troopers and because of the type of law enforcement VPSO system that they have out there. You know, anything to assist those officers in pursuing a quality investigation can only be a positive.
Are there any questions? Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the testimony. I mean, when I look at the new language, and I'm not sure that you've had an opportunity to see the CS, but the language essentially says, shall make an arrest at the time a peace officer determines to be appropriate and when the peace officer has reasonable cause to believe that a crime has been committed and the person to be arrested has admitted committing a crime to a peace officer or a peace officer has listened to a recording of the admission. I mean, I guess I assume that's the way it worked now. I mean, could you give to me some kind of an example in which that wouldn't happen?
Are you addressing that question?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I am.
Oh, no problem. Well, you know, my office is not necessarily in support of the arrest, the mandatory arrest provision in here. I don't think that the arrest issue is a problem, but what we are specifically supporting is that Section 2 that allows the council to adopt regulations setting the minimum standards for the conduct of criminal investigations. In particular, what we are in favor of is that delivering the results of the investigation to the prosecutor, addressing safety concerns of the victim, writing incident reports, and securing the crime scene. There are other, and I understand each particular crime is different, and each particular crime scene is different, and there are certain evidence collection issues that shouldn't be standardized. And arrest determinations, I think, as well, shouldn't be standardized. But for the most part, the opportunity for APSC to set certain standards and specifications is a good one.
Thanks.
Thank you, Cameron. I think Senator Bundy would like to address that question also.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Elkin. Unfortunately, that isn't the case. This bill came to me via a constituent who was aware of a situation where there was an assault, an admission of guilt, and no arrest took place. And in my further discussion with police authorities, it is to their benefit, the police authorities, sometimes to, even though they have probable cause, to not cause the arrest to occur early in the investigation, building a stronger case for the legal system, as I understand it. This is an issue that I wish to continue to address with law enforcement. My concern is protecting the public, of course, along with not tying the hands too tightly of law enforcement. And there may be a compromise where when we have people of interest, which is, I guess, a term of art for those on the other side of the law, maybe they need to be placed in the system so that most of these crimes, particularly sexual assault, are not a one-time only deal, and so that if there are other cases that are unsolved, perhaps this information is available to the police department.
Senator Elton?
Senator Bundy, would part of the decision-making process be, and I don't know the terms of art like persons of interest, but would it be not arresting a little fish because you think there might be big fish out there?
Mr. Chairman, I think that could be an example. It might be not arresting the big fish right away because you want the big fish to be really hook themselves thoroughly before, to continue the analogy, before it goes through the prosecution.
Almost sorry I used that analogy.
But none of them would be farmed.
Thank you, Senator Bundy. Any further questions of Tamara? Thank you for your testimony, Tamara. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next, here in Juneau, we have Sarah Lynn Tabachnik. Tabachnik. Okay. I wasn't even close.
Very close.
Closer to the sun, maybe, huh?
You got my first name totally right, so that's challenge for many.
Thank you for testifying today. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm the executive director of AWARE, Aiding Women in Abuse and Rape Emergencies here in Juneau. I'm here to speak on behalf of victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. Being a victim of these two crimes is one of the most difficult to report, and therefore I think two of the most underreported. You know, if your car gets hit and run, you can feel indignant about that and call law enforcement and feel like they should do something about it. But unfortunately, with domestic violence and sexual assault, survivors often feel shame and a sense of guilt or responsibility. And for these reasons, it's often very difficult for victims to come forward and identify themselves as survivors. People make judgments about survivors, rape survivors, domestic violence survivors, that they don't make about car owners whose cars got hit and run during the night. And also, they make judgments about survivors that they don't make about survivors of other violent crimes. For the most part, it seems to me that law enforcement work very hard to do a good job to investigate crimes of domestic and sexual assaults. The message that peace officers send to domestic and sexual assault survivors, those brave enough to report the assaults to them, needs to be clear and direct in both words and action. Survivors need to know and feel that peace officers are doing everything they can to investigate and build the best case possible. so that prosecution can move forward where the victim feels empowered rather than re-victimized at every point in this process. This legislation provides accountability, which I believe can have a tremendous impact on holding perpetrators accountable and thereby provide greater opportunity for survivors to heal from their victimization. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. And would you turn your testimony in, your written testimony? Appreciate it. So we put it in the packets next time. Oops. Any further testimony? Okay. Well, at this time, we're going to hold this bill until next time, scheduled next week sometime, I'm sure, when Senator Terrio is back. Thank you, Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next bill for us today, and we don't plan to move this bill out either. We're going to hold it after the introduction of the bill and the testimony, is the Senate Bill 132, Human Rights Commission. Chandy Young.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Darwin Peterson. I'm Deputy Legislative Director in the Office of Governor Murkowski. And I'm pleased to be here today on behalf of the governor to present this bill to you for your review. Here sitting next to me, I have Janda Young from the Department of Law, who will take over once I give the initial introduction of the bill and answer any detailed questions. If the committee desires, she could even do a section-by-section analysis. So to begin, I would first like to just thank the Alaska State Commission on Human Rights for the hard work that they do. We're joined in the behind me by some of the commissioners today, and they have a yeoman's duty, Mr. Chairman, but they do great work, and with this bill the governor intends to enhance their efforts and improve the efficiency of the commission. This bill intends to allow the commission to evaluate complaints of unlawful discrimination and to allocate its resources to prosecuting those complaints that will best serve the Commission's goal of eliminating unlawful discrimination. There's procedures in here to improve the Commission's, I'm sorry, provisions in here to improve the Commission's procedures and to enhance the fairness of those procedures, and also provisions to clarify the remedies that the Commission may award to remedy unlawful discrimination. There's also a few miscellaneous housekeeping changes in the bill, Mr. Chairman. With that, I will turn it over to Janda Young and let her answer any specific questions, unless you have any questions for me, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Mr. Peterson? Okay. Do you have any presentation, or are you just here to answer questions?
I can take you through the section by section if that's what you would like, or I can answer questions.
Why don't you take us through section by section?
I'd be happy to do that. I thought also it might be useful to know a version of this bill did pass the Senate last year, and so I'm going to try to point out the differences between the bill before you today and the one that came through last year, because that might be helpful to know. Section 1 of the bill would amend 1880-100 to ensure that a complainant can withdraw a complaint of unlawful discrimination during the investigation and conciliation phases of the procedures. Basically, what this would do to the existing statute is it makes it clear that, I mean, not only can the person file the complaint, but they have the capacity to withdraw the complaint at any time if they wanted to. And that's important in this bill because the bill gives the executive director enhanced discretion to choose whether to take a bill forward or not. And so this would give the individual an opportunity, if they didn't like the decision that was being made, or to withdraw and then go to court or to other procedures that would be available to the person.
Mr. Chair, are you...
Senator, I'll
all the way through.
No, go ahead. Go ahead and ask questions away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Jan. In some investigative bodies, I'm thinking of my service on the Legislative Ethics Committee, the Legislative Ethics Committee, for example, can file their own complaint and move forward. Does the Human Rights Commission have that authority, and this would not abridge that authority?
That's correct. The executive director and I believe even the commissioners do have the authority to file complaints of unlawful discrimination.
So if a complainant does with, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, so if a complainant does withdraw a complaint, the commission still has the ability to file a new complaint on the same instance or circumstance?
Yes, I believe so. Continue. Section 2, again, would add two subsections to the bill. This one addresses the authority of the executive director to file a complaint. That's a carryover from the statute as it exists right now. Subsection C, that's in Section 2, would add a statute of limitations of 180 days after complaint. This simply takes the existing statute of limitations in commission regulation and move it into the statute.
Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Jan, I'm trying to look at details, so if you think I'm being too nitpicky, just say so, and I won't be offended at all. Back to the initial question. My understanding is that some of the commission investigations can proceed for a long period of time. And so if you have an investigation that has been going on for 2 years, and the complainant withdraws, this statute of limitations would preclude the commission from filing, because if the investigation has been going on for 2 years and you have 180-day statute of limitations, the complainant could withdraw, but the commission would not then have the ability to file its own complaint.
That is true. What the individual would probably be doing in that circumstance, at least in my experience, is going to court, and the opportunity or the statute of limitations for a judicial action is much longer. So presumably they're withdrawing because they want to take control over the action, and then they would have the opportunity to go to court. So the commission would need to be acting within their own statute of limitations also.
Your response, Jan, and maybe the commission is, I think, is listening, and so they can respond to it too when they come up. It would seem to me that one of the provisions could be, given the fact that there could be a long investigation, the complainant withdraws it, you're beyond the 180 days, so the commission would be precluded. Would it be reasonable to say a complaint may be filed not later than 180 days after the alleged discriminatory practice, or after 30 days after a complaint was withdrawn, so that you wouldn't have that, you wouldn't lose the ability to pursue a complaint that had been withdrawn?
Well, I guess if, I mean, I'm not sure, I mean, the commission can address practically if this has been a problem for them, but this is the existing framework. I mean, they have the 180 day time frame now in regulation. So, I mean, whether this has posed a problem or proven to be difficult, I don't know. And I don't know how many complaints the executive director does file herself. I mean, I don't know if that's a large number. And I don't know if that's something that she would consider or often considers after an individual complainant withdraws a complaint. So I don't know that information.
It would seem to me, though, if a individual was withdrawing their complaint to pursue it through the court system, then why would the commission want to continue with the complaint if the individual themselves wish to proceed in a different manner?
And I think that is generally the case, too, when an individual complainant does opt to go to court, and again, they can correct me. My understanding is the commission does conclude their case.
Yeah. Senator,
on that point, I think that's a good point. I mean, clearly, in that kind of an instance, you may not need to feel the need to file a complaint, but a complainant can withdraw a complaint and not go to court also, and that would leave a practice that would make that practice non-jurisdictional in the case where you have. So I, th- think your point's well taken, especially if the person is going to court. But if they're not going to court, then we're drawing this line.
So if we put an amendment in there, then we'd want to amend it if the person did not elect to pursue it in another venue. They would have the 30 day. Okay.
It may not be an issue.
We just discussed it. All right. Senator Huggins?
Well, I guess my concern is 6 months, forget curb starts to fit in. Secondarily, I'm just thinking of why people would withdraw their complaint. You know, the business of somebody else after the clock is ticking to be able to renew the complaint. I'm not so sure that I want to have language that encourages that proposition through perpetuity. So anyway, just a counterpoint.
I'll continue. Section 3, addresses what would happen if there's a settlement. It basically encourages its settlement and requires that settlement agreements, and this is by the commission with the concurrence of both the respondent and the complainant, those are put into writing and they have the force and effect of any commission order. Section 4, this adds a new provision giving the executive director expanded discretion to determine which cases to take forward to a hearing after the investigation concludes that there's substantial evidence of discrimination. And this provision is in response to a court case which reversed the commission, which had elected after investigation not to pursue a case because even though it found a prima facie case supported by substantial evidence, it had found that the evidence was either weak or the defenses were strong and it wasn't a strong case meriting a hearing. And the Supreme Court reversed that and said all cases with a substantial evidence finding must go to hearing. So the purpose of Section 4, which is one of the keystones of the bill, is to expand that discretion to allow the executive director to make the kinds of choices that a prosecutor, for example, would make in determining whether to pursue to prosecute a crime. You know, the cooperation of the complaining witness, the strength of the evidence, public policy to be served, and whether there are any good defenses against the prima facie charge. Section 5 addresses the hearing provisions, and this does a little maybe I should address, in Section 4, we did narrow the listing of items that the executive director could consider when deciding whether to go forward with a case to hearing as a result of testimony that came out in the House State Affairs Committee last year. It was believed that there were some duplicative and some unnecessary provisions, and so those were weeded out. Section 5 on the hearing does a couple of things. One of the things it does that's different this year is that it coordinates with the central panel hearing officer system that was adopted by the legislature last year. And so that bill did bring the Human Rights Commission into the central hearing office so that the chief administrative law judge would be appointing hearing officers to hear Human Rights Commission cases beginning July 1 of this year. This bill makes a minor change to that by expanding the number of provisions in the hearing officer bill that will apply to the commission. In other words, rather than just the appointment authority, the ability to disqualify a hearing officer for bias, the provisions about public records, some of the other sort of mechanics of how the central panel system will also be applied to the Human Rights Commission under this bill in Section 5. It also brings the bill into the Administrative Procedures Act to bring the Human Rights Commission into closer conformity with the standard for most administrative agencies in the state. Unless there's a specific provision in the law which control, any specific provisions in the human rights law would control over the general provisions in the Administrative Procedures Act. The bill in subsection C addresses amendments to a complaint after it's referred for a hearing, and it does allow reasonable and fair amendments to the accusation that is issued against a respondent, but it does require that any new charges be supported by the same kind of substantial evidence finding that was required initially of the basic charges, and it also requires an opportunity for the respondent and the complainant to go through the conciliation process so that there's no, circumventing the settlement opportunity through the amendment process. The subsection D would add a burden of proof to set the standard at a preponderance of the evidence, which is the general standard that is used both in court and in most administrative hearings. And finally, in subsection E, there's a provision adding a summary judgment type process similar to a judicial summary judgment, which would allow the commission to decide a case without a formal hearing with live witnesses if there are no disputes over facts and only disputes on the law. Section 6 addresses an important component of the bill, which is the remedial provisions. The goal here, and they're addressed principally the employment area because that is the area where most of the commission's work is done, but to make the process more predictable and certain for both the complainant and for the respondent. It incorporates into statute the case law, which says that that remedies are economic remedies that the commission can award. They don't award punitive damages. They don't award non-economic financial remedies such as pain and suffering. And so that would incorporate that into the statute, so that would be clear for all to know that that's what the commission's authority is. The remedial provision also makes reinstatement the principal remedy for an employment discrimination, if that's possible. And a restoration of any back pay that's lost. If it's impossible for circumstances that are laid out in the bill to return a person to work, and this can happen sometimes because the relationship is so deteriorated to make it impossible for the person to return to work, there is the possibility to award front pay. But since that is a speculative and forward-looking remedy, future remedy, a cap at 1 year is placed on that remedy. There are also a number of conforming amendments that are made. One other additional provision that changed from the last year's bill is Section 12. The word pay is defined, and the reason for that is to ensure that when back pay or front pay are awarded, that is a full remedy to the victim, and it's not simply salary. In other words, if there's benefits or some other remuneration associated with the employment, that is included in a front pay or back pay award. It's intended to be included. And another, minor difference between this bill and last year's bill is that there's a July 2nd effective date, and the reason for that is for an orderly adoption that, knits together nicely with the effective date of the central panel office's authority to appoint the hearing officer. So these provisions would take effect a day after those provisions take effect. And unless there are any questions, that's all I have.
Senator Elton.
And I apologize because I know you're making a comparison between last year and this year. This is the first time I've looked at this in depth, and so I also may need some help on what existing provisions are. Are you saying that in this section that when you're talking about non-economic or punitive damages, they're not, this is just restating existing practice that the commission does not now
award non-economic or punitive damages?
My understanding is it does not award non-economic and punitive damages, but there's also a court case, Johnson versus Department of Fish and Game, which makes it very clear that the court does not consider that the commission has that authority.
In a second question on this section, and you may have to help me out with the definition up front, but why would you limit that to not more than 1 year? It seems to me that there are going to be many classes of employment or many professional duties in which, for example, and I'm going to use an example, and you can tell me if it fits or not, that you may have been discriminated against, lost your job as an accountant in a firm that has one accountant, and there may not be an opening at an equivalent professional level for 3 years or 10 years or 12 years. So why the limitation on 1 year?
Well, I guess, first of all, you have to remember that when the decision issues, the person would be made whole up to the date of the decision under the back pay, you know, regardless of the delay or the amount of time. So it's important that we're always speculating into the future when you're awarding front pay. And the idea of a cap, and my understanding is that front pay is a very uncommon award, not one that gets awarded very often. And the norm is the expectation that the person, if they can't be restored to the position that they should have had but for the unlawful discrimination, which is the strong preference of the law and the commission, as I understand it, but that 1 year would be a reasonable amount of time for that person to be able to mitigate through some reasonable efforts to find another position.
Further questions?
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, is somebody scheduled to speak from the commission?
They're here. They can answer questions if you would like.
I just wondered if they had any comments, although I'm just asking questions. Everything is okay.
Who wants to address comments?
I believe I would like to address a few comments. Just wondering if our executive director, Ms. Pauling,
okay,
who was also present, would like to comment on.
Sure. Why don't you come up to the table here, then?
Members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, my name is Lisa Fitzpatrick. I am currently the chairperson of the commission, and also with us, I'd like to recognize Grace Merkus, who is a member of our commission, and Commissioner Ruth Benson, who is also here, and we have a staff attorney, Steve Kotev. And with me here at the table is Paula Haley, who is our executive director and has been for 17 years now. We have been in conversation with the governor's office about this bill, and we have noted to the governor's office that we generally support the bill, but there is one provision in particular, and actually, as the conversation about front pay was just raised, it actually reminds me that there was a second area that we had some concern about, and it specifically pertains to the one-year limit on the relief of front pay. This was in the bill last year. At that time, there was a two-year limit on the front pay, and we took the position that it would be better to have no limit whatsoever, because it is such a unique remedy that if the situation were such that we wanted to invoke that as a remedy, then it would really be fact-specific, and it would be better to not put any time limit on it. And actually what happened in committee hearing was there was a motion made to reduce it to 1 year, and so, you know, instead of getting more, we got less. And so it is a provision that does give us some concern, but it is very important to have at least some form of front pay out there. The only provision of the bill that we are very concerned about is a provision in Section 4, which was not addressed in the review of the bill, the section-by-section analysis that we just did. And that provision which is at the bottom of Section 2, provides that when the executive director does issue an order dismissing the complaint, because there has been a failure of finding of substantial evidence, the commission may, in its discretion, review the director's order of dismissal and may affirm the order, remand the complaint for further investigation, or refer the complaint for conference, conciliation, and persuasion if it concludes that substantial evidence supports the complaint. And I would like, just before addressing this, to go back and explain just some of the historical reasoning behind our position opposing this particular language. There was a provision in regulation, never in statute, but by regulation, and I'm not sure what the genesis of it was or how long it was in place, but it was at least there as early as the early 1980s, that basically provided for what we termed in the agency, I don't know if this regulatory language was specifically using the word, but we called it reconsideration, which essentially gave the commission the ability to review a director's order dismissing for failure of finding of substantial evidence. And during recent years, we have experienced a decline in overall funding. There have been about 20% budget reduction over the last 5 years, and it's been very difficult for the agency to meet the existing caseload that we're presently experiencing. So in an overall looking at our resources and looking at what our workload consists of, a determination was made, and I believe the determination was actually, the conversation about reconsiderations was initiated with the Department of Law, because the Department of Law historically assisted the commission in reviewing these requests for reconsideration. And the decision was made to repeal the regulation providing for reconsideration. And the reasoning was we did a cost-benefit analysis. We looked at the cases where reconsideration had been sought, and we analyzed that somewhere on the order of about 10% of the individuals whose cases were dismissed for failure of substantial evidence sought reconsideration. And of those cases, about 1% were referred by the commissioners back to the agency for further action. And of those 1% that were referred back, about, is it 0.14% then resulted in a change in the decision making. So given the minimis number of cases affected and the even smaller number of change that resulted from the dismissal, reconsideration, we determined that it draws down a tremendous amount of resources and that it was not cost effective to continue doing these. And I might add that the reconsideration process entails someone makes the request. There's, the size of the cases varies, but you know it's very frequent that there's quite a volume of paperwork that's has to first be gone through, because the case law says that the individual is entitled to the entire contents of the file, and there are oftentimes within the file confidential documents, pieces of information that businesses have provided in the course of the investigation, which they do not want released either to the complainant or to the general public. And so it requires a review by the agency of if there's something in there that can or cannot actually be released. And then it's transmitted to a commissioner who has to review this case file. And I happen to have a law degree, but the average commissioner does not. It's a circumstance that I happen to have it. It's not required for the position. And they're very difficult cases to factually analyze. And you don't, to determine whether or not there's substantial evidence, the only thing you can do is to review all of the evidence and go back through the file and look at all of the information that's been obtained in the course of the investigation. So it's time consuming, and it's challenging intellectually from a legal standpoint what qualifies as substantial evidence. And so invariably commissioners have invoked the assistance of the Attorney General's office in trying to do a case-by-case analysis. And it's an individual commissioner who's assigned to a case. It's not the entire body. And So it would require, once again, invoking resources at the Attorney General's office. But in addition, the Attorney General's office never assists the staff or the agency when the state is a party, is the respondent, is an employer in the case. And so in those instances, it would be necessary for the to hire an outside attorney to assist the agency or to assist the commissioner in making the determination. So it sounds terrific to have one more layer of review, but in practice, it is time-consuming, and it is something that inherently involves the additional resources. So we are looking for ways to pare down at this point, and to create more work is not something that we would support at this juncture.
Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. If this stays in here, will the commission be preparing a fiscal note?
Well, I believe a fiscal note was prepared and submitted to the governor's office, but I believe that the governor's office made a determination that a fiscal note was not necessary.
What I think I heard. You think there will be a fiscal impact. They, you're doing the work. They didn't think there would be a fiscal impact. If you remember, maybe you could tell us how big the fiscal note was.
I believe it was on the order of about $5,000-$6,000. Correct.
Further questions?
Okay.
Senator Davis.
So other than that section, everything else seems to be to your satisfaction?
Yes.
And also, what bill was it that passed last year? I don't remember the bill number.
I don't remember it either.
354, I believe. Senate Bill 354?
It didn't pass the House.
It did not pass the House, correct.
Oh, it just passed the Senate, but not...
It just cleared it to the Senate. Right. It didn't make it through the House.
Okay.
Chair, I have one question.
Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many total commissioners do you have?
We have seven. We have actually a vacancy right now because...
What's the geographic distribution of them, do you know?
We have two commissioners from Fairbanks, one from Soldotna, one from Whittier, two from Anchorage,
and the vacancy.
We had a commissioner resign because she moved out of state.
In terms, or how long?
They're five-year terms.
Five-year terms. Is there a staggering factor?
They are.
Yeah. And you're satisfied with the process of how you get on, and everybody has an opportunity to be a member if they'd like. It's advertised.
Oh, I honestly don't know what the procedure is for recruiting individuals for the commission.
And that's done through the Office of the Boards and Commissions.
And the Governor's
people,
Office.
You know, they both solicit names and people submit names. It's a pretty standard process. Did you have anything to add?
Chairperson Wagner, committee members, no. If you have specific questions, since okay. I'm most familiar with the workings, the day-to-day workings of the commission, I'm happy to assist.
Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Paul, I don't know if you remember the question I asked of the presenter from the governor's office, or I think it was maybe the attorney general's office, about whether or not I should be concerned about the language on page 2, lines 7 through 9, that says a complaint may not be filed later than 180 days. And I was wondering how that might, whether or not that is of concern to the commission in those cases where you may have been working on a complaint for a couple of years, the complainant withdraws it for some reason, and that 180 days would preclude you from having the commission file its own complaint. Is that a problem, or would that not be a problem?
Chairperson Wagner, committee members, Senator Elkins, I don't think, practically speaking, it's a problem in that, as was pointed out, frequently when complainants withdraw, we either will see them seek an alternative, you know, source of redress, or they've lost interest and they may not be the best witness for us as we pursue the complaint. I have to say there have been rare occasions when we have refiled. and perhaps it's been better than 15 years ago. So I understand the force of your question, the thrust of your question, when, and I think to address some of the other concerns that were raised, there was a broad public policy impact in the allegations of discrimination. They affected more than that one complaining party. Because just to underscore our role, we are not put in place to be advocates for any complainant that comes to us. We are advocates for the public policy that the state of Alaska, this legislature, has put forth to prevent and eliminate discrimination. And most commonly, we see this in the workplace. So, for example, a situation where there was rampant claim of sexual harassment, multiple witnesses, and the one complaining party who brought the case withdrew and decided to drop the matter, I could see us having that concern. Has it happened? Probably only a handful of times that we've had the very concern you mentioned, to think ahead and possibly substitute. And it is true the 180 days may well bar us from doing so.
Senator Elton. Paul, I'm sorry. I'm trying to listen, and I guess I'm trying to gauge how much heartburn you have with this and whether or not we should consider amending that provision.
Well, Chairperson Wagner and committee members and Senator Elkins, I have to say you raised it today, and I sort of went, wow, I hadn't thought about that for a long time. I would generally, because it is the commissioners who decide policy positions on these bills as well as general matters, I would probably go back to them and ask them what their concern is. I just want you to know, since you specifically asked the question, it would be a rare occurrence, but it could be a potential problem. I raised the sexual harassment example because actually coming on the heels of the bill you just heard before ours, sometimes victims in those circumstances decide they're embarrassed, they don't want to have to be in a hearing and describe the touching or some of the other things that occurred, but there may be other potential witnesses who were also victims of the harassment in the workplace who would come forward. So it's an extremely rare event, and I certainly can bring it up with the commissioners and ask them, in light of your question, how they would feel about that.
And Mr. Chair, I'd just say, if you do, you could maybe let the committee staff and know what your preference might be, and they can distribute it to the committee members.
And one correction, it is Senator Elton, not Elkins, and I make the same mistake. He's getting used to it now.
Well, my apologies, anyone who knows me, these are never my strong suit.
Well, thank you both very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we'll hold this bill, and it will come up again. We'll be sure to address Section 4 at that time. Thank you. With that, meeting's adjourned.
Yes, I'm going to be in late.